Today, we intersect with two icons of pop culture who talk with us about their current interests and observations, Jonah Raskin and Joel Selvin. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea.
I'm never gonna cry, never gonna cry. I'm never gonna cry no more. Because I'm coming out, and I'm gonna knock on the happiness door. Yes, I am, and I'm gonna let them know I'll find a love worth living for.
We've been listening to Hoagy Lanz, just one of the vocalists produced by legendary record producer Burt Burns, the subject of Joel Selvin's latest book. Musician, producer, and KRCB's Doug Jane has a colorful conversation with Selvin about the patterned story of the darker side of the music business through the prism of music producer Burt Burns, who may be obscure to us now, but not if I rattled off a bunch of his hit songs. But I'll let Joel and Doug do that for you a little later in the broadcast.
Then tell me, why am I still crying tears, darling, over you? Tell me, please.
Now, however, let's turn to author, poet, and explorer of culture, Jonah Raskin. The Life and Times of Abby Hoffman, American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the Making of the Beat Generation, The Radical Jack London, Marijuana Land, and Field Days are just a subset of Raskin's titles. A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature, his latest book, is a meditation on nature, wilderness, the American identity, and our heritage in American literature. Raskin is professor emeritus at Sonoma State University, reviews books for the San Francisco Chronicle, and is a frequent contributor of radio essays on KQED. Here is my conversation with Jonah Raskin.
A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature. Why don't we just take it from the title? And this is a book that you say it's been in you for a long time.
Yes.
And that
right.
You've been compelled to approach this subject, and which has a lot to do with 19th century literature.
Yes.
And talk a little bit about that.
All right. Well, Suzanne, I just was thinking that I believe you know quite a bit or have deep feelings for trees, right?
I do.
And so, I mean, trees are part of the story that I'm writing about. I mean, trees, there's individual trees, there's American writers Europeans who came here were just amazed at the different kind of species of trees, how many trees there were and the beauty of the trees and woods and forests in the New World or North America, as it was called, were also spectacular compared with Europe, because for hundreds of years people had been chopping down trees and using them for shipbuilding and fences and houses. And so that's in part why they said it was a new world, because it seemed to have all the things that had been depleted in the old world. And they had they believed that whatever was here, all the resources would never run out. There was so much that human beings could never use it all up. And the story, what happened was that you were using up resources from woods on the East Coast to buffalo and oysters in San Francisco Bay. Now, it is also true that nature or the wild is resilient, and it very often does come back. Humanity, our species, is trying to help bring it back.
There is that sense of hope. You end the book on a note of hope, yet it seems that a lot of the work that you focus on really describes not only that abundance that is before people, but also the destruction of that abundance or the conquering of that abundance, especially when it comes to the native people who lived here too. So it seems that there is that constant struggle of conquering ownership, domination.
Yes.
And we've never really come to terms with that. We still have this feeling that this abundance is going to continue.
Yes. Right. I still hear people say that they talk about the amazing fecundity. That's the word that I've heard people use of in this whole Bay Area. And yes, you can go out and walk around and see the diversity of life, but I just on coming here on the radio, I heard a report that the salmon returning to the streams in Marin is the lowest it has ever been. It has been for the last decade and a half. So, and a lot of people say like the salmon are the equivalent of the canaries in the gold mine. So there is something very sad and unfortunate that's going on here, the loss of our salmon population and especially the cohos. You know, it's a story that's also told in a new movie that's called The Russian River, All Rivers, and of what's happened to the fish population. It used to be that the fish were an integral part of Indian life around here and as for food and part of ritual. And there may have been some exaggeration, but they used to say, Indian tales used to say, there'd be so many salmon in the rivers you could walk across a stream that there were so many, right?
And the same, I think, has been said about birds darkening the sky as they flew overhead.
Yes.
In the book, you talk a lot about the writing of James Fenimore Cooper.
Yes.
And I read Cooper in maybe junior high or high school, and as you ticked off some of the titles, I thought, gee, I think I might have read that book. But at the time, perhaps I didn't have an understanding. I mean, I know I didn't get into it at the time. I don't know if they're still in the curriculum today, if the Deerslayer, for instance, is part of what young people read these days. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, James Fenimore Cooper is still read. He's not read as much as it used to be. It used to be like you went to college, you had to read James Fenimore Cooper. It was part of being an American, was to read The Last of the Mohicans and the Pioneers and the Deerslayer and the Prairie. And in more recent times, I would say maybe the last 30 or so years, Cooper has been gently edged out of the curriculum, and writers, women writers and writers of color have been put in his place, which I think is a good thing, because for a long time people thought, well, it's only white men who are writing about the wild and the wilderness. But beginning in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, there were lots of women writers, very fine women writers like Catherine Maria Sedgwick and Lydia Maria Child, who they read James Fenimore Cooper, and they said let's feminize the Cooper's landscape. They decided consciously to tell stories about women who go into the wild and into the wilderness. And they are basically different stories than the stories that Cooper told. They're much less about conquering and having control, and they're much more about living in harmony with the continent, with the world of nature. And they also have a different view about sex and romance and the two races or ethnicities getting together. Cooper was like really afraid of mixing of what he would call blood of redskins and palefaces as he saw them getting together, whereas the white writers, the white women writers, Sedgwick and Child, wrote about romances and between Indian men and white women and places where Indian men, the women go into the wilderness and they live happily ever after there. I mean, that is also part of the American story. From the earliest times, there were people who saw the value of Indian society. Now, the person to me who's the father of wilderness writing is Roger Williams, who's best known as the for creating the state of Rhode Island, and a very unusual, unique person. He lived part of his life in England and part in the United States. He was friendly with John Milton, and he was a great linguist. And he wrote the first wilderness poems, consciously writing poems about the place that he called the wilderness. He recognized that it had a poetic appeal and poetic force. So he realized that the Indians had government, they had stories, they had families, they had customs and rituals, they had beliefs. They farmed. Indians
were not savages.
Exactly. They had a civilization, all of their own. And
that kind of perspective isn't the one that took off?
Right. It mostly became a kind of dichotomy. We're the people who are civilized, and you're the savages, and we have to convert you to civilization. Unfortunate, because I think there are a lot of things that settlers and colonists could have learned from the Indians about how to survive and how to live without having to conquer it.
So, Jonah, in your book, you're quoting Cooper saying that books are in a great measure the instruments of controlling the opinions of a nation like ours.
Yes.
They're an engine alike powerful to save or to destroy.
Yes.
So you felt compelled to write this book, and it is your push or attempt to save something, to inspire people to be more cognizant.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that people, we can look to our own literature for inspiration. We can go back to Thoreau and reread Walden or read the sort of essays that Thoreau wrote about walking and around Concord, Massachusetts, or going to Maine, the woods of Maine, and seeing what was going on there, or Emerson's essays about nature, or reading Willa Cather's like O Pioneers, which is, again, it's like it's a story. The main character is a woman, and she learns how to live in this very harsh environment in Nebraska, the prairies of Nebraska, where, it's cold and it's windy and it's hot. Willa Cather does suggest that it's the old Europeans who bring with them to this, what I would call a kind of godforsaken land, sort of a European appreciation of the soil and of nature. I think it is something, well, D.H. Lawrence also says it when he writes about American literature, that Europeans have this kind of connection to the soil and to the earth that maybe because they lived there for, they and their ancestors had lived there for hundreds and thousands of years, that they really felt connected to the place, whereas Americans for so long came here and felt like alien and not rooted. And the stories that they often told were about people who were rootless and alienated from the place. And so I've heard people say, and I've been saying it myself, that we knew part of the what we need to do, I believe, is to tell different stories, to change the narrative, and to begin to tell stories about the ways that we're connected to this place, connected to the land, to the wilderness. And there are real connections. We're not just, making up fairy tales. We're not alien. We're not just strangers. I mean, there may be times and places where we feel it's a strange landscape, but that we do also feel at home here. And Americans, we have created some wonderful places. I mean, the national parks are are a wonderful part of American society, that Theodore Roosevelt and John Muir and many others sort of recognized that if Americans went about the way they'd been going, that there would be very little of the wild left.
I wonder, did you have a personal epiphany or at some point in your life come to find the value you derive from being in nature?
I became aware of the California environment, I would say. It took a while, but I started to get attached to the hillsides around here in Northern California in September or October, after months of no rain, where the sun has been beating down and they're turning golden or brown, or even, you know, in this past winter, some of the hillsides even turned like kind of brown black. Somebody said it was a kind of fungus that was on plants that turned them that color. So I got to appreciate, to see the beauty not in the green, the lush green landscape, but this very dry golden or brown landscape. I mean, the hillsides around here are really spectacularly beautiful. I hope that they're not going to be covered with houses. I know that they've been inspiring to artists like Jack Stupin, and sometimes when I look at the landscapes, I see it through his eyes or through his landscapes. And that has enabled me to feel at home here. I know that I also began to feel connected to the landscape here when I met local farmers and worked on organic farms. And I mean, the farm that I have felt the most connection to is Oak Hill Farm in Glen Ellen, where there's no gate that you have to close and open to get in. There's no fence around the place. It has about 40 acres of cultivated fields, and then it has about 700 acres of woodland. And there's no barrier between what we've called the wild and the cultivated. And there's creatures who are going back and forth, and it's a great watershed. It helps to provide all kinds of habitat, and I think that it makes the land that's cultivated richer. And I mean, it also adds to the beauty of the place.
Rewilding.
And there was a conference that took place in September in Vallejo that was in part about this, and that I attended, and that was really inspiring. And although there were also some difficult stories, or stories that were hard to hear, that were told by some of the Indians from California, there was a walk around the seashore in Vallejo. The ocean is a very wild place. I often go out to Point Reyes, and you get to the end of the land, and you look out at the Pacific, and that's really wild. I mean, I know there's also all kinds of garbage floating around there. I mean, the Pacific, the oceans are another kind of wilderness that we also have to save. I mean, it's all around us.
And it is all around us. And I think the understanding of what nature can provide to us, both spiritually, physically, and
yes,
as a culture,
right,
is something that many of us don't understand it. And I hope that your book might be a pathway for some people, and that your book is steeped in our literary heritage.
Friends, both inside and outside of academia, have told me that this book can be useful, because there's a lot of talk these days about climate change, global climate change, of from, and a lot of it, they say, comes from the sciences and environmental sciences and biology, and that there is a need for humanities classes and humanities approaches to climate change and the environmental issues that are happening here. So that is, I would say, is one of my deepest hopes, is that this book finds readers in colleges and high schools who care about what's happening globally, the whole global environmental crisis that we're in, and to be able to look back at our literature and to learn, to take lessons and from this vast storehouse of our literature. Yeah. So.
Well, Jonah, thanks so much for coming in and talking about your book. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with about A Terrible Beauty? And maybe you'll tell us where you got the title from, A Terrible Beauty.
Yeah, yes. The title is from a poem by William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet. So I selected that because I think that if people saw the wilderness as a place of beauty, but they were also terrified by it. So that, and the two of those things seemed like they kind of, sometimes they merged. The idea is also expressed in a William Blake poem, A Fearful Symmetry, where he's writing about the tiger, 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 burning bright in the forest of the night. This sort of the fear we've had of this sort of very beautiful places in the world. There's something about beauty that seems to terrify.
I think we also have an irrational, well, I think it's irrational fear of animals, of big animals. We have wolves that are finding their way, just a few, back into California, mm-hmm. yet there is this fear about what the wolves are going to do, and even cougars, mountain lions, if they pick off a sheep now and then, they must be destroyed. And so I think we still harbor that fear of things that maybe it is irrational. We have guns.
Yes. Well, I was talking about Oak Hill Farm and not fencing out or not keeping out the forested wild place. There are mountain lions in the Myokymus that are just above the fields. And I mean, I know that, and they know it because they have motion detector cameras up there. I've seen the images of the lions. And so for a very long time, they've been able to live there and farm there and work there. And the mountain lions and all kinds of other critters have been up there, and they've been able to live side by side, nobody being attacked and no animals, no hunting parties going up there to kill them. So I also wanted to say that Wallace Stegner, who was a very influential and inspiring environmental writer from the 20th century, talked about the geography of hope, that when he looked at the landscape, led him to sort of optimism and to be inspired. And there is that ending in The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, in which he imagines this group of Dutch sailors who've just come from across the Atlantic Ocean from Europe, and they see the New World, and it's green, and it's wonderful, and it's beautiful, and it's like they've never seen anything, and they have this incredible sort of sense of wonder. He definitely, F. Scott Fitzgerald, he definitely wanted to end the book on this sort of hopeful note. He didn't want to end it with Gatsby's death, or he didn't want to end it with this description he has earlier in the book of what he calls the wasteland, where it's everything is polluted and the rivers and the air and it's all gray and dark. And
I thought that was a different perspective. I thought it was of Fitzgerald and the Great Gatsby, and I appreciated your being able to bring that out, because I think it might not be something that we all would have gotten.
Yes, I haven't heard too many people, if any, like really notice that part of the book. People usually say it's about class and or the American dream, and I think that the recent movie of the Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio, it sort of missed the whole environmental part of the book, really. That's crucial for F. Scott Fitzgerald. I grew up in Gatsby country. I grew up on Long Island when I was a boy. I was talking about the woods that I could go to. I also saw in my boyhood the end of those woods and fields and the coming of suburbia and tract housing every place. But reading The Great Gatsby from an environmental glasses on, I did notice that he writes about, Fitzgerald writes about the lilacs and frogs and this great expanse of the Long Island Sound that he is writing about people with fast cars and big houses, but he also notices that there's this really spectacular natural landscape there. I would like to hope that people can slow down and really notice the wild, maybe in their own backyard.
You'd quote Gary Snyder, and it's just what you were just talking about. The wild is a territory, not a part of the agency of humanity. It could be a strip of earth in your own backyard, or it could be Yosemite. Wherever it is, it takes care of itself.
Yeah. Yes. I like that. Yeah.
A Terrible Beauty, The Wilderness of American Literature by Jonah Raskin. Jonah, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Jonah Raskin, A Terrible Beauty. I'm Suzanne Lang. We'll take a short break. When we come back, Doug Jane talks with Joel Selvin. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea.
When babe, leave you all alone, and nobody called you on the phone. Don't you feel like crying? Come on, baby, cry to me. When you're all alone in your lonely room, oh, when there's nothing but the smell of your perfume. Don't you feel like crying? Don't you feel like crying, like crying, like crying? Come on, babe, cry to me. Nothing can be said.
can you see? Oh, come on, babe. Come on, babe. Come on, come on, come on and walk with me. When you're waiting for a voice to come, late, late, late in the night. Don't you feel like crying? Don't you feel like crying,
like crying, like crying?
Come on, babe. Come on, come on. Cry to me.
We're listening to Betty Harris sing Cry to Me, produced by Burt Burns, the subject of longtime San Francisco music critic Joel Selvin's latest book, Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Joel Selvin was music critic with the San Francisco Chronicle from 1972 until 2009, and has been writing about music, musicians, and the music industry for most of his life. Here's Doug Jane in conversation with Joel Selvin.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Burt Burns. Let's start by telling everyone who Burt Burns is.
Well, I'll tell you, Doug, I may have found the last great untold rock and roll story. This man's name first came to my attention a long time ago, and I noted the records that he made had certain similar characteristics that resonated with me, and I started paying attention to it. And the more I paid attention to it, the more it opened up. And I came to learn the details of the man's life story. He was stricken with rheumatic fever at age 14. In 1945, that was a death sentence. There was no open-heart surgery. He was told he probably wouldn't live to be 21. He never went back to school. He pretty much gave up anything of discipline, just became a ne'er-do-well, played piano and hung out at mambo parlors. At age 31, still alive, he gets into the record business. And within a year and a half, he's enormously successful, and he proceeds to propel himself to the very top ranks of the rhythm and blues world at the absolute height of New York's ascendancy in that world.
Can you give a little list of short list of the tunes?
He goes from a songwriter with a hit Little Bit of Soap by the Jarmels to a producing a record for Atlantic Records with Solomon Burke, Cry to Me, and then producing a second version of a song he wrote called Twist and Shout that Phil Spector had screwed up the original version of, and he produced it with the Isley Brothers. That was a huge hit record. Then he became a staff producer for Atlantic. He saved there at a very dry period, pumped out hits by Solomon Burke, Drifters Under the Boardwalk, reestablished that franchise. At that point, his old songs are being recorded in England. Twist and Shout's a worldwide hit by someone called the Beatles. So he goes over to England, produces a bunch of groups there, comes back the next year. He's given a group called Them with a singer named Van Morrison. He gives them one of his songs, Here Comes the Night. It's the number two hit in England. It establishes Them and makes Van Morrison.
And that Here Comes the Night was one of that he wrote.
That's a Burt Burns song. Yeah. Wow. He sat there in that studio on his acoustic guitar and played it for him.
And he recorded or wrote songs with different names too, right?
So his name was Bertrand Russell Burns, and there's a lot of Burt Russell songs. In the latter part of his career, he formed a partnership with Atlantic Records to start his own record label, Bang Records, by which time he'd become personally and professionally associated with members of the criminal underworld. And at some point, it became incumbent upon him to use those associations to negotiate with Atlantic Records. He scared the hell out of Neil Diamond, who was signed his label, and threatened Van Morrison with these people. And then at the height of all this fury, he dropped dead at age 37 from the heart attack he'd been expecting since he was 14. It's a almost operatic story, and it's got so many details and little pieces in it because a lot of the narrative is tied to the ambitions of the owners of Atlantic Records and their efforts to try and sell the company while keeping it afloat.
I get the feeling that with those guys, too, like with Ahmed and Jerry Wexler, because they lived so long, they were able to kind of rewrite their persona. The way their image was much softer. And perhaps maybe if Burt Burns would have lived to be 75 years old, you know, there might be a warm and fuzzy story about him
Jerry Wexler
somewhere.
Was a very avuncular, warm, expansive guy. He could be very temperamental and fiercely proud and arrogant, but he was a charming guy to spend an evening with and do an interview. Did it many times. And Wexler did buff his reputation. The guy that I knew was not the guy who was described to me by the people I talked to for this book. They saw much more of a Sammy Glick, a very ambitious, lustful, temperamental, arrogant guy that didn't let anything get in the way of his getting what he wants. That's at odds with the picture that was painted of him as the sort of gray eminence that he was later in his life. And Ahmet, too, buffed his reputation. And I don't mean to say that these guys weren't both wonderful characters and made great contributions. It's just they take on a different form in the account.
Right, or any more than Burt was totally a whack guy, too, because he had a lot of people that spoke of him fondly, that they had good sessions with him, and he was very animated, I guess, and talked fast, but there was people that had good things to say about Burt Burns.
Burt Burns was a controversial character. I think people liked him a lot. He was warm and friendly. As he got more successful, he became more frantic, and he became more associated with these dark powers. There's beatings, there's threats, there's smoke bombings. It's an interesting kind of hero. The moral universe of the rhythm and blues world is something I go into great detail in the book. It is always an arena where mobsters operated on the periphery and not the edge, but Roulette Records was the front end of the syndicate. This has never really been written about or researched that much before, but in order to really set Burns' story in the precise moral universe, I go to great detail to try and explain how this whole rhythm and blues world operated. The book, in many ways, is as much a biography, for instance, of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller as it is Burns. Burns' life and career is the framing device, without any question, and it drives the narrative. I'm looking at the work of Burt Bacharach and Phil Spector. The Atlantic Record guys are huge characters in this book, Lieber and Stoller, of course. And all these people interacted with Burns in important ways in business and musically. So it's an ensemble portrait in many ways.
Right. I think that it's great that you do get involved with talking about Atlantic Records and stuff, and you're kind of framing Burt's story around what's going on in the world of music at the time and not assuming that everyone's heard of Atlantic Records and knows what's going on. So you really are kind of putting the era in a context.
Well, it's a terribly dense and detailed book at some times. My editor, Charlie Winton, he said that Burns' life is a prism, is a lens for this subject. And I think that's accurate. He's got this very dramatic life story, and it wraps around this incredible moment in an art form that had been developing. Just at the time that all those incredible songwriting teams like Thomas and Schumann and Goffin and King and Mann and Wheel, Sadaka and Greenfield bloomed, and those incredible record producers, Bacharach and Spector and Lieber and Stoller, and Luther Dixon is a guy that's very underrated. All those people were just blossoming at the time that Burns was operating in the same offices and the same studios and using the same musicians.
You know, a lot of his really great songs are lesser known ones, too. I was checking out a collection with some of the tunes, and some of the ones on here are not household names, but he has amazingly great songs. And the sound of them, the Phil Spector sound, which he kind of has that sound through all of his stuff, this is really kind of all over.
A lot of mambo in his thing. He was the king of Cuban rock and roll. The thing, Doug, that strikes me about Burns' music and always has is there's just this tremendous urgency to it. Just from the very first line, he's shoving his singers in corners, and they may not make literal sense, but he gets them pushed over to where they're right on the edge of hysteria, and this kind of dark energy pervades them. Even a song like, say, Cry to Me, which is essentially a love song, but it's all the content is all about being lonely and how terrible it is not being loved. And it's a song filled with despair, not happiness. So I tuned into that, and I find that element is a part, is just pervades his music. And I associate that with his doomed life, that when other songwriters can make up songs employing all the cliches around similes and metaphors with hearts, when Burt Burns writes, "Take it, take another little piece of my heart," he's writing his own pathology.
I want to ask you about what it's like to write a book about someone that you never met versus someone like Rick Nelson. When you talk about Rick Nelson as a young boy, we all see him in our brain. And when you talk about Burt Burns at all, we don't see them. I mean, the folks listening right now don't know what he looks like. Run over to Google and take a look at Burt Burns.
Is the cover photograph great?
It is so great. And, of course, he's got the bad ticker, but what's he got hanging from his mouth?
Shades, cigarette, his acoustic guitar. That's the guitar he wrote Twist and Shout on. He only owned one guitar in his life. I've held that guitar in my hands and strummed it.
Ah, wow.
So,
What is it, a Goya?
A Goya, yeah. It's a cheap guitar. Yeah. But a lot of songs in that cheap guitar. So I wrote a book about Sly Stone. It was an oral history, and I never met him. I had met him in the past. But the thing about Sly Stone was when you talk to somebody who had met him and interacted with him, they remembered it so vividly. Oh, yeah, Sly walked in, you know, and they... Mm-hmm. When I was talking to people about these recording sessions or these encounters or their careers, it had been such a workaday world for those people. It was unremarkable in many ways. Artie Butler, who was the great arranger that did so many of these records, he did Cherry Cherry, he did What a Wonderful World. He was a brilliant musician, and his name is on a lot of small print. He says, "Geez, Joel, I don't know. It's like trying to remember wallpaper you hung 40 years ago."
Right.
So this was a very interesting world to try and penetrate and recreate because it was so evanescent. It lasted so briefly.
Tell me about more songs. Getting more stories.
Like these
about,
stories?
Yeah.
Ask me about Under the Boardwalk.
Tell us about Under the Boardwalk, Joel.
So Under the Boardwalk was a song that Wexler wanted the Drifters to record. Burns didn't really care for it that much. He had a song he wrote called I Don't Want to Go On Without You that he liked as the...
And who wrote Under the Boardwalk?
It was a song team called by Artie Resnick and Kenny Young. They were out of Trinity Music, TM Music, TM Music.
Okay.
Real building song. They hadn't had a hit before. And so I Don't Want to Go On Without You, Burt routined with baritone singer Charlie Thomas. Rudy Lewis was going to sing Under the Boardwalk. The morning of the session, Rudy Lewis woke up dead, died of a drug overdose in his bed in his hotel room. Charlie Thomas had to stop by on the way to the session and close the dead man's eyes. Wexler didn't want to cancel the session. So, changed a couple keys, cut a couple extra tracks. Now Johnny Moore's the lead vocalist on Under the Boardwalk. They knock that out real quick. And then they bring on Charlie Thomas to sing I Don't Want to Go On Without You. Suddenly, this song has a completely different meaning.
I want to ask you also about collaborating, writing books, because you've done, you collaborated with Sammy Hagar,
mm-hmm.
right? You collaborated with Ed Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that actually like being a co-writer and a co-artist with someone, or are you more like the producer and kind of directing them? So
if I'm writing a book like Sammy Hagar's autobiography or Ed Hardy's autobiography, my job is to be entirely transparent and to give the reader the experience of having Ed or Sammy tell them their story. These guys aren't illiterate, but they're not writers. We conduct long tape-recorded interviews. I get the transcripts. And I work with the transcripts until I've got them to tell their story in their voice. I love these things.
Yeah, it sounds great. You got more coming up?
I'm working with a record producer named L.A. Reed, who is responsible for Mariah Carey's comeback, the whole L.A. face thing of the 90s, TLC, Outkast, and Justin Bieber was one of his discoveries.
Wow.
So he's a real interesting guy. He was a drummer from Cincinnati that is now running Epic Records, and he's got a great career, and he's got a great story, and he's got a great voice, and I'm really excited about it.
Tell me about the play of Burt Burns.
There's a musical. It's going into previews at the Signature Theater in New York on June 21st. It's called Peace of My Heart. And it leans very heavily on the doomed heart and the gangster angle. Plus, it has the adult daughter who doesn't remember her father. Because Burns had three children that don't remember him. They were all under 3 years old when he died. The adult daughter trying to discover her father and reconcile with her mother. So it's got all these kind of like story elements going. And the music, what do you know, it fits like jigsaw pieces. I went to a reading of this. And Jerry Ragavoy, who was a Burns song collaborator, wrote Peace of My Heart with Burns and Cry Baby and worked with Burt all his life, was sitting in front of me. And the final three songs are almost melodramatic. And, and I sat behind Jerry Ragavoy as he took off his glasses and with one hand conducted the band through these last three songs, two of which he was a writer of, and the other hand he wiped tears out of his eyes. Quite a moment. Sissy Houston was there. She was, like, blown away by the whole thing. I think it's going to be a very surprising musical. Nobody's expecting this kind of story out of this music.
People seem ready to be swept up by stories of people they don't know. I'm thinking of the Rodriguez thing that happened.
Doug, so I took this book to every major publisher in New York, and the answer was always the same. It was, nobody's heard of this guy. Now the book's coming out, and the reaction I'm hearing at this point is, wow, nobody's heard of this guy. So you never know what to say about conventional wisdom. I guess it's like military intelligence and jumbo shrimp, right?
Well, it is so weird that he has all these songs that are just so famous. They're just, I mean, once you hear them, you just know, you know the song, but you don't think of him. Going back to Phil Spector, his sound is so overwhelming that when you hear a Phil Spector song, you don't think, oh, it's the Crystals. Oh, that's Darlene Love or whoever. You just know it's a Phil Spector thing. Where I think because his stuff was a little more diverse and, you know, he seemed to make his arrangements for the song, they didn't have necessarily quite the sound that...
Oh, there's a Burt Burns sound. I'll tell you what it is, okay? Think about Phil Spector's record with the Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Love and Feeling. You know that record very well, I'm sure. Think about the breakdown where the two voices go, yeah. Do you really know what's going on underneath that? Doom, 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 doom. Tribute to Burt Burns.
Okay.
It's not just the lick. He's got a certain kind of Baroque approach to the R&B sound. It's most evident on the Solomon Burke records. The Hoagie Land single, that's a lost gem. And that's got that sound. There's records that are a little bit more Afro-Cuban, like the original version of My Girl Sloopy by the Vibrations. And there's stuff that's more suited towards like the British rock idiom of the mid-60s, like Here Comes the Night or I Want Candy by the Strangeloves. And then has got more further into the world of soul music as opposed to R&B. There's some interesting pieces with like Wilson Pickett, Come Home Baby, a Man and Wheel song, kind of a in between the R&B era and the soul era. And then firmly in the soul era, number one R&B record from 1966, Are You Lonely For Me Baby by Freddie Scott. Mm. Very much in the Stax Volt Memphis soul bag.
What you were saying about how the music will get kind of a groove And then the vocals almost sounded like they were recorded too hot. Like the music is just grooving at a nice level and everything, and the vocals are just really pushing it. And the background vocals are singing one thing, and then the lead vocals kind of comping over it, and really, really, really great.
Burns records are all about voices. He wants those singers just up front and in your face and sounding very desperate. Cry to Me by Betty Harris, 19-year-old girl, never been in the recording studio together. And he just pulls this vocal performance out of her. It's chilling.
So the story's not over, though. You're still talking about the book. The book's coming out today, right? Is today the release date for the book?
Well, April 15th. Yeah, this has been an extraordinary experience for me, Doug, as a writer, as a journalist, whatever the hell I've done professionally.
You know, just having everyone know who he is awesome. Good job, man.
Thank you, Doug. Good. I'm so glad to be up here.
I'm so glad you came in. Good luck with the book. Good luck with the book tour. And you're going to be at the grand opening of the Peace of My Heart when it opens on Broadway or wherever it's going to open?
I would miss it. And we're going back to do some work with the book. April 22nd at the Bitter End, we're going to do a Burt Burns book party with special music appearances by Benny King, Brenda Reed of the Exciters, and Betty Harris, along with some cast members from the musical. So we're going to have a little splash in New York, and then we're going to be back to take on Broadway. And there's a documentary film in the works, and we're hearing from movie producers, and yeah, you know.
A hit. You're going to have a hit.
Your lips, God's ears, babe. You know, Doug, it's just been fantastic over the years to witness all the contributions you've made up here in the North Bay to the music scene. I don't know how many people have been so many different things, record store owner, recording artist, concert producer, radio broadcaster. I admire your work.
Thanks.
Opportunity to express that admiration.
Appreciate it.
Going past.
Well, we're both pretty lucky to be able to make a living in the music business.
Oh, man, it's like not working at all.
Just like that.
Doug Jane talking with Joel Selvin on Here Comes the Night, the dark soul of Burt Burns and the dirty business of rhythm and blues. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard from Jonah Raskin on A Terrible Beauty, the Wilderness of American Literature. A Novel Idea is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Public Media. We have production assistance from Sean Knight, Wendy Nicholson, and Mary Moore Campagna. Listen to us online and subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's A Novel Idea.